Nightlife with Philip Clark
on ABC Radio.
And joining us for a look at Nightlife News Breakdown is Barry Cassidy, former host of Insiders, political journalist, of course, with many years of experience of tramping the corridors of Parliament and elsewhere too. Barry, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip.
The Robodebt Royal Commission, it's getting coverage. The former Attorney General Christian Porter took the stand today. Alan Tudge, of course, the minister responsible, has also been giving evidence. How are you making, or what are you making of it so far?
Yeah, it is getting coverage, some coverage. It's very patchy and interesting in itself. I think I thought 7:30 tonight was had an excellent coverage on it. But what surprised me, Alan Tudge was up yesterday, the relevant minister, for the first time, and there was nothing in the Sydney Morning Herald or the Telegraph about any of that, which surprised me a bit. But basically, I think what's coming through, and you see it in the faces of those conducting the inquiry anyway, that they will surely find this is going to be one of the most outrageous, if not cruel and insensitive acts by any government in a very long time, that they did in fact, knowingly or otherwise, perhaps they weren't curious enough about it, but they ran an illegal scheme to claw back money, and in the process, a lot of very vulnerable people were wrongly accused of a debt, and some of them paid a very high price.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, one of the things that seems to have emerged quite strongly from this is, and this is really the damning thing, is that the ministers, the relevant ministers, and indeed Christian Porter certainly, knew the scheme was illegal or knew the government had advice that it was illegal. And certainly in the bureaucracy, they'd certainly had advice that it was illegal or that there were legal issues with it. And yet they proceeded. Alan Tudge says, "Oh well, I never knew that," which is seems to be the new level of responsibility when you're a minister. That is, if you don't know anything, it's not your fault.
Don't ask. Don't ask, and then you've got plausible deniability. That's what seemed to have happened here. Alan Tudge spent a lot of time blaming others for what had been going on under his watch, and you know, there is such a thing as a ministerial responsibility, and I think that'll be made clear to him a little further down the track. But, you know, what also I think is came through yesterday, not so much today, but yesterday, was how callous and indifferent the government was to the whole thing anyway, whether they knew it was legal or not. Because rather than get to the bottom of it and rather than investigate whether or not it was legal and follow up on some of these cases that were coming through that just didn't sit right, that people were giving, you know, chapter and verse as to why they'd been dudded in this way, you'd think they would say, well, we'd better have a close look at these cases. But instead, they did the opposite. They doubled down. And what they did was that they got the files from some of these people who have been, quite frankly, a lot of them were innocent and they've been persecuted, and they got the files on them and in some cases passed on this information to the media. So it's their attitude, their strategy was a media strategy in response, not fixing it, but to discredit the complainants.
Yes, well, indeed. I think one of Alan Tudge's staff confirmed that in the Royal Commission, that was exactly the intention, was to quell any criticism of the scheme by leaking proactive stories to friendly media.
Yeah, this is Rochelle Miller, who worked with Alan Tudge for a while and, in fact, had an affair with him at one point. And she was saying that they classified the media as the left and the right. And it was the left media that were starting to run stories on this, and that the alarm bells were starting to ring in certain aspects of the media, and they're finding case studies. But so what they did was then to go to the friendly right-wing media, and the Australian in particular, and leak this personal information and then bring material forward that would try and discredit the reports that were being put out there. Like, for example, they gave a case of Simon Benson in the Australian who ran a story, and I think it was headlined that this story had backfired on the opposition being the Labor Party at the time. So it just demonstrated that, I mean, if it's a real insight, really, into how media, the relationship between the media and government can work, the most essential thing for political journalists is to hold all political parties, but particularly governments, to account. what we find here is that they were complicit in protecting a government when they should have been casting a very critical eye over this scheme themselves. Rather than do that, they were complicit, and they folded into the government narrative to protect them from quite an evil thing that was going on.
What do we make? I mean, is there a point to be made here too about the quality of advice going to the government? We've always in Australia been quite pleased to pride ourselves on the fact that we've got a professional public service, and in many instances, I think, particularly in foreign affairs, that's probably true. We have a high quality advice going to the government. I mean, you do have to wonder here, don't you, as to what was going on at the very senior levels of the public service itself, because they knew this scheme had problems, and yet still pushed it up the line to the minister's desk. And according to Alan Tudge, never really told him that there were serious problems.
And one of the key lawyers in the public service insisted that it wasn't illegal. Hmm. So that the quality of the advice was suffering, but also there has been a tendency, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years, for public servants to become more partisan and to tell the government what it wants to hear. The narrative behind all of this was there were so many dull bludgers in the welfare system, and we're weeding them out, and they would think that the public would then stand up and cheer them for that, because there is this built-in prejudice out there that there are these hundreds and thousands of people who are somehow rorting the system. There are a few that do that. But in the end, I think it was 2% or something. It was nothing like the kind of problem that they were presenting it as. And so the public servants increasingly, I think, they're starting to become a part of the process, and they're telling them, if that's the government's narrative, they will give them information that helps to feed that narrative.
Hmm. Yes, indeed. Given the perhaps partisan way that News Limited participated in coverage of this whole affair, it's not surprising to see that their coverage of the Robert Ett Royal Commission has been limited, I think you would have to, in all fairness, say.
Yeah, because I think it would be embarrassing to them if they were to be giving a ball-by-ball description of what's been going on. Look, it really is, it's the newspaper and those who run it have to ask themselves now, did we hold the government accountable on this issue through that period? Because that is essentially their task, as it is for the rest of the media. Mm. And quite frankly, the rest of the media also should have asked themselves, why wasn't this a bigger issue during the federal election campaign and the run-up to the campaign? Look, people raised it and then it would disappear, but it was never a major concern within the... But just think of the trauma and the way that when examples of people who suicided were brought forward, and there was this totally indifferent, almost callous... the Rachel Miller, who I mentioned before, she said in a memo, what a great start to the weekend for us. She said this person, you know, was rorting the system, and what a great start to the weekend for us. This person had taken his own life. Now, whether he can't say for certain whether it was directly related to the fact that he suddenly had this debt that he didn't know about, but to have that kind of callous indifference to the lives of others is not what you'd expect from a government today.
No, Barry Cassidy's with us, former Insiders host, of course, and long-standing political journalist in Canberra. What are you making of opposition leader Peter Dutton's positioning on The Voice? He has agreed to be part of the Voice to Parliament working group. He was attending the funeral for Cardinal Pell today, but he did dial into the Voice to Parliament working group. He says he wants to hear more.
He dialed in today.
I mean, people think, well, that's positive. The Voice, the whole Voice discussion, of course, is going to hot up from here. Is Mr. Dutton sort of seeking a position here, or do you think he's already formulated one? Some suggest that he's got nothing to lose by opposing it, as the Nats do. I mean, the Nats have decided to oppose it. Others think if he does oppose it, he's leading the Liberal Party down a path that, from which there might be no return. What do you think about it?
Yeah, well, today he did dial in today, and he will be. He's promised to be back the next time they meet in mid-February. But again, essentially what he was saying is that he was critical of the process. He wasn't going to the substance of it at all in his comments, just critical of the process. It should have been a constitutional convention leading up to this, and I want answers about the scope and the content of The Voice. So he's continuing with his strategy, but he just raises doubts around the process And then, you know, it's Bronwyn Bishop's been saying this, and Paul Keating used this term against John Hewson during Fightback. If you don't understand it, don't vote for it.
Hmm.
And it's almost like he's building up this kind of approach so that he doesn't look as if he's being indifferent to the Indigenous community. He just doesn't like the process. The problem with all of that is that it can't be done that way. The Constitution is essentially a collection of broad principles. You lay out the broad principles in the Constitution, but the Parliament then determines how to put those principles into practice. That's the way it works. And so Anthony Albanese wouldn't be able to make promises when he goes to the people with this proposition about how it works, because that will be depend on the political cycle. You know, this government might say, well, this is the way it works, but 3 years from now, another government will say, well, we want it to work in another way. The point of the concept of the referendum is to at least put the principle in place.
Mm.
So there will come a point, I think, when the media will start asking Peter Dutton, and I'm amazed that they haven't asked this essential question even before now, but are you, in principle, in support of recognising Indigenous Australians in the Constitution?
Well, he's answered that question, hasn't he? He says yes.
Well, it depends, isn't it?
Well, it depends on the details. He might be walking both sides of the street, but he when asked that question, he does say, yes, I am. But, you know,
the minister has. I'm not so sure that Peter Dutton is as emphatic as that on it. But in any case, there must come a time when and Anthony Albanese is starting to develop this kind of approach. But there comes a time when the media and others are entitled to say to Peter Dutton, well, okay, how do you want it to work? And how could it work so that you would be satisfied with it and then vote for it? What's the mechanism? Because he raises things like how will they elect these people? We need a definition of what is an Indigenous Australian and so on. And, you know, you raise all of those issues. Well, they can be tackled in the Parliament when the time comes and they do determine how to work. And I think that's when the rubber hits the road for Peter Dutton, because it's not just an obligation on the government to put forward an idea. The Liberal Party too has to have ideas around how it would work or not work, and that's at that stage when we'll start to see whether this is just a spoiling tactic or there's a genuine concern there.
Well, I think Ken White would say, well, they've had plenty of time to discuss it because I took it to Cabinet twice. And they've discussed it a few times already. Just finally, the $5 note. No, I don't know whether you see many of these days, given the absence of cash generally. Charles, the monarch of Australia, is not going to have his head on the currency. Has the government and the Reserve Bank's decided, and the government's agreed with that. Mr. Dutton's going to come out with his fists, rather than just saying okay, he's sort of arcing up about this. Is it an issue in the community, do you think, or not?
I think it will be. I think it's an easy one for people to understand and debate. He says this concept that rather than have King Charles on the note, you have images reflecting Australia's long history of Indigenous culture and so on. So you might have images like Uluru or whatever, and he said that's woke nonsense. I just find that quite extraordinary. I mean, the use of that term anyway, I mean, what a flippant kind of expression it is, woke nonsense. But to dismiss it in that way and just assume that the majority of Australians that he's supposed to represent would prefer Prince Charles on the $5 note rather than images.
Not Prince Charles anymore.
Sorry, King Charles III.
Come on, Barry, get with the program. It's King Charles.
And especially given that he will remain on the coins. But, you know, it's interesting, when the Queen first appeared on the $5 note back in the 90s, Paul Keating was opposed to the idea. Interesting, and you'd expect that. But so was the leader of the opposition, a guy called John Hewson. He opposed the idea, but it went ahead anyway. And for 30 years, that's been the case. But you would think now with the passing of the Queen, it's time to have another think about it.
Yep. Anyway, well, we shall see. Barry, always good to talk. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.